Hi, this is Dan Sheridan. It's a pleasure once again spending time with you in the Word of God. We're going through the Old Testament line by line, studying all of our favorite topics and seeking answers to all the tough questions that we have in the context and flow of the Word of God. And we come today to Genesis chapter 25, and let's just dig right in. And then we read in verse 1 of chapter 25, we read, "Then again Abraham took a wife, and her name was Keturah. And so, and she bore him Zimran and Jokshan and Medan and Midian, Ishbak and Shua." So here's Abraham, and he's no longer sterile, by the way. So I believe that God renewed the youth of both Abraham and Sarah when they were able to have children beyond the age. Remember, we talked about this as when God gave Abraham and Sarah the ability to bear children in their old age, it was proof of his resurrection power. And we see that power is still available for Abraham to have children here. He's no longer sterile, and he's able to perform the functions necessary to produce children. And so we see in verse 3, "And Jokshan begot Sheba and Dedan, and the sons of Dedan were Ashurim and Letushim and Leumim, and the sons of Midian, Ephah and Epher and Hanak and Abida and Elda." All these were the sons of Keturah. And by the way, just a quick reminder, I claim no authority for my pronunciation of some of these names, so I'm just doing the best I can. And it says, "And Abraham gave all that he had unto Isaac." Now, this word "all," we have to be careful in the use of it in certain contexts here. When it says he gave all that he had unto Isaac, in the next verse we read, "But unto his son, unto the sons of the concubines which Abraham had, Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac his son while he yet lived, eastward unto the east country." So when it says he gave all to Isaac, it's in reference to the fact that Isaac was given the position of the firstborn in the household. He's the one through whom the line of promise was coming. But he still gave things to these other children and so forth. And notice, too, it doesn't mean that they were cut off from all contact. As we saw, we're going to see throughout Genesis here, Abraham Ishmael, I'm sure, did not cease contact. Ishmael and Isaac didn't cease contact, as we're going to see in a few moments that they bury Abraham. And Jacob and Esau didn't cease being in contact with each other. There's just a lot of things that aren't recorded. When he sends them away, it's, Isaac, this is his position here. He's going to run these things. He's going to have the position of the firstborn, and the rest of the sons he has to send away to have their own position somewhere else. They are not part of the agreement between God and Abraham and Isaac. And so it doesn't mean he cut them off. And then it says in verse 7, "And these are the days of the years of Abraham's life, which he lived." I like that addition there. And these are the days of the years of Abraham's life, which he lived. Abraham lived a life. And that's good advice, by the way, to live life. The life we have now is something that we can enjoy. We can know success in the Christian life, whether we're full of riches or full of poverty, or whether we're full of good health or we don't have too good health at all. My wife and I, my family, we've never been wealthy. For the most of our lives, we haven't been able to save and enjoy vacations and things of that nature, but we're happy. I don't enjoy good health in the sense I have spinal degenerative disease, had it for years. So I've lived in pain my whole life and have not had what we might call riches. But I'm happy. What makes me happy is the fact that I know God. This book genuinely gives me comfort, knowledge. The more I get to know God and learn about what he's done and what he's doing and what he's going to do, the more it makes me happy. The more it makes me want to walk worthy now, knowing that there's a future under God, and we're going to enter into that one day. And in the meantime, we have the privilege right now of enjoying life. So this is the life which he lived. He lived life, and we saw throughout the life of Abraham what he did. It wasn't all exciting. It wasn't, like the movies, the action movies, where you go from one action scene to another. Abraham spent his life, he was involved in politics and commerce and family matters and so forth, was struggling over water rights and what have you, even was involved in an international war, as we saw. He lived life, and he lived it, and he looked the whole time. His whole life was lived knowing that there's a city coming whose builder and maker is God, and he acted accordingly. But he lived life, and that's just a wonderful thing to think about. And it says, "And Abraham gave up the ghost and died in a good old age, an old man." And the King James reads, "full of years." I like how the, I think it's Young's literal, it's he was satisfied. He died old and satisfied, and he was gathered unto his people. In other words, he joined them in death. And he didn't go to heaven, or he didn't go to Abraham's bosom, as some like to say. Because what was Abraham's bosom before Abraham was there, if it's a place for, you know, for the dead? Go back to listener studies on Luke 16 for more of those details. But anyway, so here's Abraham. He gives up the ghost. He dies in a good old age, an old man and full or satisfied. We might add the ellipsis with years, and he was gathered unto his people. And it says that in verse 9, "And his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar the Hittite, which is before Mamre. The field which Abraham purchased of the sons of Heth, was there was Abraham buried, and Sarah his wife." And there's an emphasis here on this purchase, because it's an emphasis on the fact it's a resurrection plot. We saw Abraham purchase this plot in Genesis chapter 23, and how the hope of resurrection, the fulfillment of the promises of God, was right before him. And that's why it's emphasized here, because this is the place that Abraham bought in the full hope of resurrection. And it says, "And it came to pass after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac dwelt by the well Lahairoi." Now, I want you to notice something here that's important. And as I've mentioned before in our studies of Genesis, there's sometimes you got to read between the lines, and there's a lot that's not recorded. The reason why Abraham is taken off the scene here is that there's no more to be said about Abraham. And that's why this his death is recorded here. He lived, now keep this in mind, he lived until Jacob was 15. And that's 75 years after the birth of Isaac. So in some of the things that we're going to read about in the following chapters, Abraham's still alive. And but God takes him, when it comes to recording the narrative, there's nothing more to be said about Abraham, and that's why we're going to go and dwell upon Isaac. And we'll make some more comments on that as we go. All right. One other thing I want to make a comment on is that Ishmael and Isaac bury their father, Abraham. Remember, Ishmael is the one that was sent away to, because, you know, the son of the promise, the son of the bondwoman, "I'll be heir with my son, even with Isaac." And Ishmael's going to be a wild man, we read, and so forth. But here they are coming together. Here they are coming together to bury their father. And like I said in just a few moments ago, it didn't mean that Isaac and Ishmael didn't maintain contact all those years. Maybe Ishmael came to terms and recognized the promises of God and bowed to them. Remember, that choice of Isaac had nothing to do whether one was saved or lost in the evangelical sense. It's just that God chose Abraham, and then through Abraham, Isaac, to be the conduits of promise. It had nothing to do with God choosing one to be saved and one to be lost. It had to do with promises. And so here's Ishmael and Isaac burying their father. They came together at the end to bury their dad. And beloved, let me just say this. One day, Ishmael and Isaac, too, will be in harmony. And today we see Ishmael and Isaac divided as ever with their hatreds. And yet, through the work of the Lord Jesus Christ, there will be harmony again. They, too, will come together. These people will come together, and that'll be a glorious future. All right, let's go to verse 12. So God is going to tell us about Ishmael's family here in verses 12 to 18 for the very reason I just said he's recording it here for the same reason he recorded the death of Abraham, because there's nothing more going to be said about Ishmael. So he's going to sum it all up here and then get Ishmael out of the way to focus on the life of Isaac. And so verse 12 we read, "Now these are the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's handmaid, bore unto Abraham. And these are the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names, according to their generations. The firstborn of Ishmael, Nebajoth, and Kedar, and Adbeel, and Mibsam, and Mishma, and Duma, and Massa, Hadar, and Tamar, and Jetur, Naphish, and Kedema." Listen, look at all these children. It always seems that the line of promise is the one that's having trouble having children, but not here, not for Ishmael. And it goes on and says in verse 16, these are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their towns and by their castles, 12 princes according to their nations. And these are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years, and he gave up the ghost and died and was gathered unto his people. And they dwelt from Havilah unto Shur, that is before Egypt, as thou goest toward Assyria. And a King James says, and he died in the presence of all his brethren, and I don't think that's the right translation. Bullinger has a very good note here. It says that his lot fell in the presence of all his brethren. They were side by side, and so it was. As to a geography, not in the place where he died, but as to the geography of the two people. All right, so that's how Ishmael goes off the scene, and now we're going to pick it up with Isaac. In verse 19, and these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife, the daughter of Bethuel the Syrian, of Padan Aram, the sister to Laban the Syrian. And then it says, and Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife, because she was barren. Now, I want you to imagine here for a minute. This is the line of promise, having trouble having seed. God says, in Abraham, and your seed, all the nations of the earth and all the families of the earth will be blessed, and yet they had a hard time having children. And I think there's a reason for that, because God is the God of resurrection, and he wants them to trust in him. The line of promise had to depend upon God's miraculous acts, and that's a great principle here. So it says, and Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And I would imagine at this point, because Abraham's still alive, that I can imagine that Isaac would consult his dad. Hey, Dad, what do I do? And I can imagine saying, Abraham, well, I can imagine Abraham saying, well, son, let me tell you the mistake I made. And he'll go back and describe what happened in Genesis 16 when he wasn't waiting out God's timing on these promises. And it seemed that Isaac and Rebekah, learned from Abraham, and that's why they went to the Lord and entreated of him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. So they asked the Lord, and the Lord answered. See, Isaac asked, and God answered. God was not silent at this time. Today, and I have to say this frankly, we don't know when we have answers to prayer, and we don't understand God's judgments today. Back then, they knew. When God judged, you knew it was God judging. We cannot claim that any storms or accidents are God's judgment. Today is the time of God's silence, the time of God's grace. And people who try to make the storms and these different events or stock market crashes or the ups and downs of the market a sign of the judgment of God are doing a great disservice to truth. And it's just not the fact. Those do not accord with the facts. Life has its ups and downs. And so for people to take natural events or economic events or what have you and try to, read into them the judgments of God, they're acting no better than the Babylonians who look to the livers to try to interpret events. And I say that, I know that's a tough saying, but God is silent. And so if God is silent, that means you have to invent things. And I'd rather not speak for God when God has not spoken. And so we have the word to go by. We live in the time of the silence of God, so let's act accordingly. And he goes on in verse 22, and the children struggled together within her, and she said, if it be so, why am I thus? And she went to inquire of the Lord. Again, remember, the heavens weren't silent, so she went and inquired of the Lord. Where did she go to, is the question. I think she probably went to a place probably of offering where they did that, where God spoke or where God communicated. When it says she went, so it seems like she went somewhere, probably to a place of sacrifice where Abraham's altar was or something like that. That could be it. Just something to think about. And then it says in verse 23, and the Lord said unto her, now notice this, he's plainly speaking. You don't get answers to prayer like this, and neither do I. You don't go to God and say, hey, God, what do you think? God doesn't speak to you. Well, let me tell you. We have been given good old-fashioned common sense today. We'll call it good old God-given common sense, and we have to act accordingly. And so God doesn't respond to us like this. But she went to inquire the Lord. The Lord said unto her, two nations are in thy womb. And this it wasn't actual nations in her womb. It was two boys. So this word nations is a figure of speech for their progeny. Two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of peoples, plural, not singular as the King James has it, two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels, and the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. Now this has nothing to do, this is not God choosing individuals become saved or lost. This is God choosing the progeny of these two boys to one is going to have the line of promise and one isn't. And there's nothing more to that. And then it says, and when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb, and the first came out red all over like a hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. And after that came his brother out, and his hand took hold on Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 80 years old when she bore them. So, he took a hold of Esau's heel. That's almost a commentary on his life. And now we go into verse 27. And the boys grew. Now they were growing up. Now remember, Abraham was there when these two boys were born. And so now they're growing up. And after they reached the age of 15, Abraham's gone. So Abraham, what happened in Genesis 25, verses 1 through verse 8, when he gave up the ghost and died, took place sometimes right here after the boys grew. And it says, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field. And Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. So it says here that Esau was a man of the field. And I think that means he was one of those guys who can live and survive anywhere. He was a man of the field. I think he lived there. That was his thing. He was an outdoorsman. But it says that Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. Bollinger's marginal note has this as an upright man dwelling in tents. And I know it's hard to believe that based off what we're going to see him do later on, but I don't have a problem with that. I think it could be right. He's an upright man dwelling in tents. It doesn't mean he was soft or effeminate, as some would say. That doesn't mean that at all. And verse 28 says, and Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob. So, you know, they had favorites here based off of certain characteristics. And mother and father had their favorites. And it says, and Jacob sod pottage, or literally he boiled stuff that was in a pot, whatever it was. And we know that the color of the stuff was red. And Esau came from the field. And that's where he was living, and he was faint. And so there was a famine. In Genesis 26, verse 1, so this famine probably drove him out of the field. He was hungry. And Esau said to Jacob, feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint. And therefore was his name called Edom. So there's a little divine commentary here that he gets his name Edom from this situation right here. And let's see what that situation is. And then it says, verse 31, and Jacob said, sell me this day thy birthright. So this phrase, this day, is a figure of speech, as if on this very day he's saying. And so, thy birthright. Now, I want you to think about the importance of this. What Jacob is doing is he's taking advantage of the fact that there's a famine. And he's taking advantage of the fact that Esau is hungry, because Jacob wants the position of the firstborn. Now, what did the position of the firstborn mean? The position of the firstborn meant you were the conduit of the promises. Abraham passed on to Isaac, and Isaac is passing on to the next child, and Jacob wanted it. And he was willing to take advantage of a situation economically to get that. Now, I don't think this is a good thing. I don't think this is a good thing at all. The one thing, though, I can appreciate is that Jacob valued the promises of God. He valued them, even though he's using what I consider corrupt means to get it. But he valued them. So he's wanting to be the one that brings the continue that line of the promise that we find in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. Now let's see what Esau does. And Esau said, behold, I am at the point to die. What profit shall this birthright do to me? All right, I'll sell it. That's what he's saying. Pardon me. So what's Esau's problem here? Self-preservation. The promise was about blessing others. But Esau was more about self-preservation, and he didn't have faith in the promises of God. Esau could have inquired of God like his mom did. He could have gone to God, or he could have done what Abraham did in Genesis chapter 22 and realized, look, I may be starving, but God's promises are sure he'll have to raise me from the dead. So Esau, for self-preservation, gave up the promises of God. He found more satisfaction in momentary needs, and hunger is a tough thing, but he chose that instead of trusting God and for God either to provide food or to resurrect him if he's going to die. And so this is what happens. So he says, I'll sell it. This birthright's no good to me. I'm about to die. And Jacob said, swear to me this day that you will sell it. And he swore unto him, and he sold his birthright unto Jacob. And then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat. Notice the ands. And he did eat and drink and rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. He didn't value it. He just got it. It's almost as if he did it without batting an eye. And that's why he's called a profane person in Hebrews 12. Now, Esau is not condemned to eternity of suffering. He wasn't chose to be locked in a pit of fire for eternity. That's nothing to do with this. Esau was a man, I believe, who believed, he was a believer who was a miserable failure here because he didn't value the promises of God. And that's what we have here with Esau. And to read any more into it is just, in my opinion, just a very sad thing. To read Calvinistic dogma into chapter 25 here is just does great disservice to the Word of God and the character of God. All right, we'll stop here. We'll pick up in Genesis chapter 26 next time. This is Dan Sheridan. Thanks for listening. You keep searching the Scriptures to see whether these things be so.